The hat that I'm putting on is the as a telehealth project manager for the Regional Coordinating Center for Hurricane Response at Morehouse School of Medicine. It's a mouthful. We call ourselves the RCC. And my good friend Martha Arrieta and I are essentially going to tag team some work that we've done in the last 5 years in response to the tragedy in the Gulf Coast. So I'd like to acknowledge the great people at Morehouse School of Medicine, as well as all of our collaborators throughout the Gulf Coast, and our funders, which are both at the federal level as well as a private funder, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. The only sort of quasi-relevant disclosure I have is that I do some work for a company called Athena Health, which does electronic health records, so it's not immediately relevant to the talk that I'm giving, but it's important that we observe full transparency. I recently came across a Tolstoy quote that said that happy families are all alike, and that every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. This quote struck me in the sense that as we were going through building these programs and looking at them, that this idea, and we'll sort of revisit it, and I encourage you to sort of keep it in the back of your head. How many people are familiar with the term telehealth? Okay. For those that do are, I tend to favor the Office for the Advancement of Telehealth's definition, which essentially boils down to three principal activities: clinical, educational, and administrative. We've heard some wonderful solutions in the mobile device arena, as well as with mobile telephones. What I'll be talking to you about is the use of telehealth in the delivery of care, whether it's a clinical service, an educational, or administrative thing. So in the late 2005, arguably the most devastating natural disaster occurred, followed by the most devastating failure of a levee system, wreaking havoc across the Gulf Coast. If anybody's from there, I lack the words to describe to you how it created this incredibly tragic public health crisis of extraordinary service need outstripping available resources, which were devastated. Dr. David Satcher at Morehouse was approached by the federal government to say, what can we do? And he came up with a six-point plan, one of which included the use of telehealth specifically to address the then predicted, now realized mental health spike, service need spike that was going to happen, and the using technological solutions in responding to that need. I tend to favor the term telehealth. You may be familiar with telemedicine, telepsychiatry, telecardiology. I think it's important to point out that within terminology, the use of these sort of varying terms has a tendency to sort of cloud what it is that we talk about. So I tend to talk about telehealth and then qualify it. So what I do is I'm you know, a psychiatric telehealth provider rather than a telepsychiatrist. Moreover, in terminology, you'll also find that we talk about different solutions, and synchronicity is also very helpful in sort of figuring out that we're all on the same page. A synchronous solution occurs in real time. An asynchronous solution occurs sort of in not real time. So, for example, the transmission of certain features that the that Karen and her colleague were sort of transmitting, it's a data point that's captured and then pushed out to some sort of server that's sort of viewed later. What I do is I actually take care of people. Video conferencing unit, you know, fires up, and I'm able to see you and say, hi, I'm Dr. Kim. What can I do for you? So that sort of gives you an idea of terminology. Why do we do this at all? Well, oftentimes people think about telehealth in terms of pushing out to these rural, remote areas. My particular soapbox issue is that it's about access rather than distance. So I don't care if you're 600 miles or six blocks. If you can't get in to see your doctor, your provider, your educator, your administrator, it's a problem. And can technology do something to sort of address that goal? Perspective is also important in talking about the deployment of telehealth services. So for most folks, I tend to adopt a risk management perspective. So rather than talk in terms of what's the gold standard of what we currently do versus this sort of novel telehealth solution, I ask instead, what are you doing now in real terms? And in most cases in the organizations that I've been fortunate enough to engage, they got nothing. So rather than nothing versus thinking about it in terms of what the theoretical gold standard is, of course you'd want to see your doctor every day, you know, well, probably not every day, but you know, as often as you want in person. If that option isn't available to you, could telehealth provide an interesting solution to you? Another idea of perspective to sort of keep in mind that I continue to sort of say over and over again in the folks that I work with is, just because you can doesn't mean you should. So it's very easy to sort of get dazzled by all of the fanciness of the technology toys. And as a self-identified gamer and sort of technophile, you can get sort of sucked into that thing. But it's very important that you sort of have some measure of apprehension before moving forward and really think things through. Ultimately, the work that I do is comprised of three components: hardware, site selection, and solution development. So the hardware that comes together are essentially off-the-shelf video conferencing appliances. The site selection has to do with both sort of the receptiveness and the interest of the people wanting to sort of engage in these distant synchronous solutions, as well as whether they're connected bandwidth-wise. So the infrastructure of your internet connection is also important. And then solution development. I tend to encourage people to think more in terms of the sort of the HRSA definition of telehealth as very, very broad and sort of all-encompassing. So rather than coming to me and saying, I would like you to help me build a telepsychiatry solution, I sort of flip it back and say, well, it seems that you're interested in telehealth, psychiatry, or mental health services being one of them. What else do you think you would want to do in towards building a scaling strategy in exploring telehealth? For the purposes of the Katrina work that we did, the RCC was fairly deliberate in how they went about approaching it. And so when I would go around knocking on doors to these traumatized folks across three states and inviting them to think about how they might use technology to redefine how they could service their communities, it was very important to the RCC that we develop autonomous, sort of self-sustaining models. If you look at the literature about the history of telehealth, it's actually riddled with the corpses of well-intended pilot programs for decades now. Literally decades of people who have sort of invested a great deal of money that, you know, when their external funding ran out, they shuttered operations. And so it was very important to us for us to engage people that would be able to run with the ball long after the RCC sort of stepped back, which is actually as we're coming down to the close of our funding cycle, we're in that exact position that I was sort of very careful to avoid having all of our collaborative partners simply say, all right, we're done. And FYI, that's not the case. They're all doing some wonderful stuff, and I'll talk about a few of my favorite ones. So the other aspect to thinking about a telehealth model, I've struggled with the appropriate graphic on trying to describe what it is that we're doing. And then I ran across a 1964 Rand memorandum by a guy named Barron, who was commissioned by the military to talk about the survivability of command and control centers in times of war. And what he did was he talked about he presented these three sort of architectural constructs, the first being centralized, the second being decentralized, and the third being a distributed model. Which model do you think Barron recommended to the military? Speak it up. Distributed. Why? It's resilient. In what way? Exactly. So this is something that we, just in looking at these, 40-year-old hand-drawn, graphics, forget the fancy network things about how, I could show you a whole list of very, very fancy graphics, but this captures exactly what we're sort of talking about. But more than talking about how you construct a model, this actually also relays a developmental timeline. And what I mean by that is that anyone interested in telehealth who engages it actually progresses through this, much like a human developmental cycle. So to begin, because we lack resources and we're sort of unsure how we're going, most people sort of construct a centralized model. If they find a doc who's interested in sort of delivering a clinical service, for example, they have a single clinical site, and they sort of push out in this sort of novel way, and it's great. Ultimately, the slightest thing can overturn this apple cart, largely because of the way it's constructed. And so it's important that you do everything you can towards maturing yourself towards, and as you emerge into the adolescent phase, into a decentralized things. You take on a couple of different docs. So if your initial sort of clinical champion sort of either is unavailable or sort of steps out, you still have some service capacity there. You expand the number of sites that you're sort of pushing this out to, because ultimately the economics of it isn't supported if you stay sort of in your siloed early centralized phase. And then finally, the goal is in sort of a fully mature telehealth network, you want to have a distributive framework where Ultimately, it doesn't really matter who or what. Everybody's sort of familiar with the technology, and they've actually, in their head, redefined how we sort of come together. So the clinical work that I do is with incarcerated juveniles. I've had the fortune of working in a couple of different facilities in the state of Louisiana at different levels of adjudication, if you're familiar with the correctional care population. So I've taken care of kids pre-adjudication in a detention center, and I've taken care of kids at the prison level once they've been sentenced to whatever crime that they've committed. I've been able to carry my care, service delivery, across a youth as they transition to facilities, which is unheard of in a traditional sense. Moreover, when one of my kids, who I'd been taking care of for a long, long time, got sent out into the community, his parole officer called me a few months later saying, we can't get him in to see a doc, and there's just no doc around to see him, and he's running out of meds. So I asked the parole officer, don't you have a Polycom unit in your office? And he said, yeah, we use that for our monthly meetings for all the POs in the state. It's like, when's your next meeting with the youth? He gave me a date, and I said, when you're done, give me a call, I'll fire my box. I punched into him, saw the youth using the equipment that was there, but historically had never really been used in this sort of fashion. And that sort of fluidity, that flexibility, that demonstrates the true power of how technology can redefine how we sort of come together. That if we can break from our traditional thoughts of how doctor and patient, or educator and patient, or administrator and clinical site come together, we can do some pretty remarkable things. So Martha represents one of my favorite collaborators at the University of South Alabama. Together, we looked at the, I guess, 4 years of effort last year of what the RCC did for these three states, and we conducted an ethnographic-like study, doing a qualitative descriptive study, engaging everybody that I touched, everybody that I talked to, everybody that engaged, regardless of whether telehealth was sort of investigated or not. And we conducted semi-structured interviews and ultimately determined seven key elements that over and over and over again, people would talk about their unhappiness, right? But as we looked at our sort of population of key informants, everybody kept talking about the same happiness. So I asked myself, did Tolstoy actually get it right? And so depending on whether you're a half full, half empty kind of person, you can talk about whether these are the sorts of areas that we really need to sort of focus our and invest our resources and attention. And for those who are sort of just emerging into the space of telehealth, and we're at a time now where I really do think that telehealth is going to move from the periphery into something that everybody's sort of familiar with. And this gets to one of our sort of final conclusions within our study that Martha is going to go into details about what we found. And that has to do with this dimension of familiarity, which I love. That until you're actually, you know, have some sense of familiarity with what we're talking about, telehealth is always going to be relegated to the periphery as some Star Trek-y, Star Wars-y, weird, whacked out thing that, you know, people do in the future on alternate dimensions. When in fact, as some of our speakers before me have stated, we're really coming together and technology is redefining how we're sort of communicating and coming together. And I find that extraordinarily exciting. So I'll leave you with a question that I'd like to ask, you know, you to ask yourselves, and that how will telehealth impact you in the work that you do? And I guarantee you that it will. And my hope is that's going to be a positive experience so that we can continue to sort of grow and get that critical mass towards this sort of novel thing. But I'd now like to turn it over to my colleague, Dr. Martha Arrieta. Currently, Dr. Arrieta is an associate professor of internal medicine at the University of South Alabama. Her major work interest focuses on access to healthcare services for underserved population, and she is pursuing telehealth as one option towards increasing such access. Originally from Peru, Dr. Arrieta graduated from the medical degree from San Agustin National University in Peru. She followed that with a master's of public health and a doctorate in epidemiology from the University of South Florida. Her initial work focus was on the migrant farm worker population, but has since sort of broadened her focus to healthcare disparities globally since her arrival to the University of South Alabama. So, please, Dr.
I have to help you get my